There are as many different ways to be a father as there are fathers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today I'll talk with three very different fathers about the choices they've made. Michael Wellman has never been one to carry around a camera. Instead of pictures, he has a box stuffed full of ticket stubs that remind him of some of the best moments he spent with his three children. He's written about those occasions in the book Stubs, A Father's Tickets to the Greatest Shows on Earth. Michael Wellman took the traditional path to fatherhood. My other guests today did not. Ralph Savarese is the adoptive father of a severely autistic son, and Mark Montgomery is the Caucasian father of two African-American sons. They've written about their families in the new collection Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. Fatherhood in many forms today, coming up after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, I'm going to talk to three very different fathers about the choices they've made, some of them very difficult, and also the rewards of fatherhood. Later this hour, I'll talk with Ralph Savarese, who's the adoptive father of a severely autistic son, and Mark Montgomery, who expanded his family through the adoption of two boys who don't share his race. They've both contributed to the new collection Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. Both Ralph and Mark took non-traditional paths toward fatherhood. My first guest took the traditional route. Michael Wellman is a father of three, and he's written about his life with his kids in the new book, Stubs, A Father's Tickets to the Greatest Shows on Earth. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, Charity.
Thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Let's talk about this box of tickets that inspired you to sit down and write this memoir of your life with your kids. Tell me about the box.
Well, I think by nature I'm kind of a sentimental fool and a nostalgist, and I've thought as I creep into middle age, that's become more and more obvious. Before I had the idea for this book, I had already gotten in the habit of tossing different kinds of trinkets and mementos and souvenirs into an old antique tabletop box that my wife had gotten me at some point, probably before I became a father. But I was rummaging through it one day for something in particular. I don't recall what. And I became aware that there were more ticket stubs in the box than any other item, let's put it that way. And the idea occurred to me that collectively they sort of formed a framework, a chronological framework of my career, so to speak, as a father.
You are a father of three. Your oldest son is Max. Is he now 20 years old?
He's 19.
19 years old. And then there's Ben.
Ben is, he'll be 17 on Super Bowl Sunday, and he's a junior in high school. And Emma just turned 14, and she starts high school next year.
It's interesting that you point out that Ben is going to be 17 on Super Bowl Sunday. This is a trend that you see throughout your book. Sporting events are a very important part of who you are. And actually attending sporting events seems to be something that is really important to you. Why do you think that's such an important part of your life?
Well, I'm not sure. I sort of grew into it innocently when I was a boy, but I think one of the points I try to make in the book is that as my kids got old enough to be taken out in the field for maneuvers, I think is how I refer to it at one point in the book. Sports were kind of my fallback. I have, to the extent that I really had any experience or expertise in anything, it was sports. But I hope to a reader what comes through in the course of the book is that some of my anxiety in the early stages of fatherhood was over the fact that I felt overwhelmingly responsible for leading my kids and blazing trails for them and showing them examples and that sort of thing. And what I've been happy and somewhat relieved to discover along the way is that particularly with Max, who is the oldest, your kids lead you, or at least mine have led me, in directions that that I didn't anticipate, and in that sense, they've really broadened my horizons.
When Max was born, the moment that a man becomes a father or a woman becomes a mother, that's a moment where I think for a lot of people it is filled with anxiety as you think, oh my gosh, I have this huge responsibility in life. Did you think then about the kind of father that you wanted to be?
Yes. I was very, as I say in the book, we became parents deliberately, and so I was very excited about the prospect. But when all of a sudden, that 9-month journey is near the finish line, I mean, it's the classic example of a point of no return. I wanted to be, I guess, without getting too specific about it, in my own mind, I wanted to be, generally speaking, I wanted to be as good a father as my father was to me. I sort of thought if I could approach the standard I'd grown up with, then things would be all right.
In your life, and you have written about this in your first memoir as well, you are a recovered alcoholic, and that was, you stopped drinking when Max was almost 3 years old.
Right.
How did that change your idea of who you are and what kind of father you could be when you stopped drinking?
Well, first of all, not to quibble with you, but I would say I consider myself a recovering as opposed to a recovered alcoholic. That distinction is important to those of us that grapple with it. It might be lost on you, but it's just an ongoing thing. It's not something that's ever finished. Having said that, I do remember Max, as you say, was a toddler. Ben was an infant. Emma had not yet been born the last time I took a drink. I just remember that I had made, prior to that time, I had made a couple of failed attempts at sobriety earlier in my life. And both of those were kind of at the suggestion of other people, key people in my life. On this occasion, I think more than on either of those prior ones, I felt personally as though I had more at stake and stood to lose more if I didn't find a way to live differently than I had. I vividly recall that one of my great fears was that if I didn't stop drinking, at some point my kids would be old enough to realize some truths about their father that I didn't want them to ever see. So that was, there's an axiom in recovery circles that you can't get sober for somebody else, but, and I see the wisdom of it, I know it at this point, but nevertheless, I think it was a great motivation for me to be the kind of father I wanted to be to my kids. I think helped me a great deal in my personal recovery.
There's another axiom in recovery circles, and it's one that you subscribe to, or at least you mention in the book, and that is that the emotional age that you are when mm-hmm. you stop drinking is the age at which you started. So by your calculation, when you stopped drinking, you were at the emotional age of 15 years old. So in some ways...
Yeah, I was a 40-year-old teenager,
right,
in some important ways.
So in some ways, you, if you follow that line of thinking, you really grew up with your kids.
Good point. And I think there is certainly a lot of truth to that. And I think maybe that accounts for, as over the course of the book, part of what you'll find in there is my personal reflections and realizations about the fact that, again, with Max as the primary example, just because he's the eldest, there were times when I realized that I think he was setting as much or more of an example for me as I felt like I was setting for him, which it seemed kind of ironic at the time, but... whatever, it sort of goes against the form chart, but it's been it's just been one of the unexpected payoffs for me of being a father.
When you decided that you wanted to write down your memories of all of the things that you did with your kids, when you started going through this box of tickets, that must have been quite an undertaking to rebuild the calendar.
Well, it was, although, again, having the ticket stubs, of course, did just build in a little bit of a dot-to-dot right off the bat that made the kind of the progression and sequence of the stories easy. I'll tell you one thing I grappled with was I hope this does not come off to readers as a gosh, I've got the greatest family in the world sort of a thing, or my family's better than yours, or seems saccharine to the point where it comes across as some cheap imitation of the Waltons. I do use the book as a bit of a segue into some pet peeves of mine that I've really become acutely aware of since becoming a dad. I guess in general, camcorders. I felt like the parents in many cases these days seem just like packs of paparazzi that follow kids around and document their lives almost daily, minute by minute. We have a camcorder, and I'm not saying that they're they are a marvelous advance, a marvelous device in many ways. I just think for me personally, I prefer the organic memories of experiences I've shared with my kids, and writing them down in the form of this book is my attempt to preserve them, and I guess in some ways my revenge of against the camcorder culture.
Well, I think that it comes across as a real love letter to your kids, and a great reminder to all of us to be present in the moment, whether we're carrying a camera or not. What do you want your kids to take away from this book? Clearly, if they haven't read it already, they will someday. What are you hoping that they'll get out of it?
Well, it'll be interesting to see as time passes and eventually when I'm gone how they regard it. I do think it's fair to say that in the case of both my books, not only my kids but their mom, my wife Chris, they've been constant sources of support and encouragement. I think it was probably easier in the case of the second book for my kids to be encouraging when the book only existed theoretically. Now that it's out there for public consumption, I hope they don't regret their support of the project. But so far, so good. They, I think it. I'll tell you this, Charity. I've always found it easier to express myself. I can express feelings in writing than I choose not to or can't one-on-one, face-to-face. So it has enabled me to say some things to my kids that maybe I haven't otherwise.
Well, Michael,
can I just mention one thing real quickly?
Very quickly.
I'm sorry I didn't title the book Battle Hymn of a Cub Father. It might have helped create an audience. I hope that reference isn't lost. Thank you.
Michael Wellman is the author of Stubbs. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about fatherhood in its different forms. I was just talking to Michael Wellman, who's the author of the new book Stubbs, A Father's Ticket to the Greatest Shows on Earth. And now we're going to talk to a couple of different fathers about different routes to fatherhood and the different choices that they've made. Mark Montgomery, who's a professor of economics at Grinnell College, will be joining us in about 15 minutes. But first, Ralph Savarese teaches American literature, disability studies, and creative writing at Grinnell College. He is a co-editor and contributor to the collection Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. Hello, Ralph.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me on.
And since you were one of the driving forces behind putting this collection together and one of the editors, I want to talk about the concept of men in the academy writing about fatherhood. But first, I want to ask you about your own personal story, because you are the father of a son who is severely autistic.
That's true.
And
yes.
You and your wife made the decision to adopt him when he was 6 years old?
That is correct. He was in foster care. He carried the label of profound mental retardation. And now he's a fully included senior at the Grinnell High School, straight-A student. He uses a computer to talk. I wrote a book that he wrote the final chapter of a couple of years ago that was published called Reasonable People. So, yes, quite a compelling young man.
And quite a compelling path toward fatherhood, because that's a very big decision to take on a challenge like that with a child who's 6 years old to become a father in that way. What made you and your wife decide that that's how you wanted to create your family?
Well, my wife, who is an autism expert, was working with my son and his birth mother, and she asked if I would serve as a kind of big brother to him. And then the state took custody of the kids because the mother had pretty severe drug and alcohol problems. And we got in deeper and deeper and had a relationship with him and had one of those moments where we thought there's just no way we can back out of this. And I would say, you know, you don't necessarily set out to adopt a child with autism, but I would say it's been certainly the richest experience I've had and also the most demanding, but incredibly rich and rewarding experience.
Well, I want to talk more about your experience as a father in a few minutes, but what made you think that putting together a collection of essays on fatherhood by men in academia was a good idea?
Well, a couple of things. One, none of my family members are in academia, and they're always teasing me about the fact that I don't seem to work. What they're really saying is I don't work a standard 9-to-5 day. I work all the time. And so thinking about what impact the flexibility of work schedule might have with respect to men doing more of the parenting tasks, both because they want to, but also to enable their partners to, if they're female, to do what they want to do. So that was part of it. But I also thought, what would happen if I brought together a bunch of men who really do thinking for a living? They think about things, whether it's race, whether it's culture. And so I asked the question, what difference does contemplative fatherhood make? Might we hear a kind of a different story about fatherhood, about what these men are trying to do? And finally, academia also tends to be a place where you'll find alternative kinship ties, familial arrangements. And that's probably the thing I'm most proud of with respect to this book. All of the different kinds of fatherhoods, whether it's single fatherhood, gay fatherhood, adoptive fatherhood, foster care, and fatherhood is not this one monolithic thing. So, and it was also a way to make the collection sort of have a theme, rather than just fatherhood by itself. Any profession would be rather large topic.
Well, and there was a collection that came out a number of years ago called Mama PhD, which was essays by women about motherhood in the academy. And in the introduction to your book, it talks about the fact that this collection doesn't share a lot in common with that first collection, because with women writing about their careers, extremely demanding careers and motherhood, there was a lot of angst and conflict that you don't tend to find among the fathers. Why do you think there's that difference?
Well, I think that women are asked to do it all or want to try to do it all, and they're held to an incredibly high standard. And when you have very active fathers, they're congratulated for that. I mean, I still think we're moving toward a notion of expecting fathers to do as much as mothers do. So I think some of it's that. I just think also the academy, the way it's set up, is perhaps more flexible with regard to the kinds of choices that people have to make. I mean, it's an evolving thing, and I think it differs from institution to institution, from person to person. But we were sort of shocked by the fact that there wasn't anywhere near as much ambivalence about the doing these two things, being an academic, a researcher, an intellectual, and being a parent. There's some of it in this book, and I voice some of it too as I try to be equitable about meeting the challenges of raising a son with a disability, but much less, as you noted, than in Mama PhD.
Were you concerned at all, or have you experienced at all something of a backlash? Because I know that there are a lot of working mothers in every field out there who would say, well, of course there's not as much angst, there's not as much conflict. And are you concerned at all that women will say that you don't have a leg to stand on when you talk about that kind of difficult decision-making that men have to do?
What I would say two things. One, we're right up front. I think, as you yourself noted in the introduction, we don't try to disguise the fact that there's less angst in this collection. But number two, if our ideal really is for both sides of the parenting unit to do their fair share, to take on the tough stuff and do the fun stuff, all of it, you know, a kind of equitable arrangement, then we've got to sort of be patient as the culture evolves. I do think many of these academic fathers are pushing the boundaries of traditional gender roles. And there are any number of single fathers in this book who have custody of their kids. And so surely the criticism wouldn't be directed at them because they're doing it all. But I do think somehow culturally we have not yet arrived at the point where there's as much flexibility or as much forgiveness with respect to not doing things perfectly as there needs to be. And men sort of do get something of a pass on that score.
Well, we do talk a lot about how motherhood has changed in the last 3 to 4 decades, and it has changed dramatically as women have really entered the workforce and do have those incredibly difficult decisions to make. But at the same time, fatherhood has evolved dramatically at the same time, and that only follows as the home life has changed so dramatically. So when you think about yourself as a father, there are things that are expected of you and things that you're willing to do and able to do that men 30 years ago never would have thought to do.
That is absolutely right. I mean, I joke with my friends that I do all of the dishes and most of the laundry, and then I wait for the applause and the little halo to go over my head, and I say, but I like doing that stuff because I can control it.
It's easier. I can do it regularly.
I feel satisfied after it's done, unlike, you know, some of the writing projects I undertake. I think that's true, and you really do get a glimpse of this. We've got Arabic fathers, Asian fathers, black fathers, white fathers, gay fathers, divorced fathers, and you have this sense of something really heterogeneous, but also moving, also changing, as you noted. Because my experience of fatherhood is radically different from what my own father did. We saw my father on the weekends. That's when we saw my father. So yes, I think it's changed dramatically. But we still have a ways to go, I think, especially too in the workplace, making sure both men and women feel comfortable saying, I can't go to that meeting because I've got to pick up my kid at school. And I'm not sure that's exactly equal now for men and women.
Of course, your experience of being a father is radically different from most people's experience of being a father, because, again, as we mentioned, you adopted a son with a severe case or a severe form of autism when he was 6 years old. And when you and your wife made that decision, you knew that there would be things expected of you, things required of you that many other parents don't have to deal with.
That's true. But what I would say is when I talk to some of my colleagues who have sons who are 16, 17, 18 right now, they are pretty alienated from their adolescent boys who are moody, sullen, don't want to talk to them. I am not having those problems with my son. In many ways, my job, the day-to-day you know, challenges of fatherhood are easier. In many ways, they're much harder. Again, we've been compensated by an incredibly rich experience. He just had a play that opened in the state high school Reader's Theater competition that he wrote about autism. He's very engaged in his studies. If anything, he works harder than I do at his studies. You know, I tell people that, yes, there are some very difficult things, but in many respects, my life is also easier than traditional fatherly, arrangements.
In your essay, you compare your life as a college professor to being a monk. Explain that comparison for us.
Well, I need to be clear about the fact that I work at a small liberal arts college at Grinnell. And the another aspect of this collection is looking at how these different kinds of institutions impact fatherhood. So at a small residential liberal arts college, we're expected to be around and on call
all of the time. It's really about close interaction with the students. And so any number of us, not just me because I have a son with a disability, but any number of us are constantly feeling torn between our families. And so I joke at the beginning of my essay that I'm like one of those monks with a secret family on the side who resents my day job as a monk. But there is this sense in which we're asked, especially in times of recession, I don't think this is just true of academia, to be really devoted to our jobs. And this business of juggling different callings or different forms of devotion can be quite frustrating, especially if you're like me, pretty compulsive about doing a good job at everything. That's tough to manage and tough to pull off all of the time.
Can you give me an example of a time when you've run headlong into that conflict between needing to be there for your family and needing to be there for your students?
Okay, so I tell my wife that I will be home at 5:30 and I will go shopping, I will make the dinner, and I'll do, chemistry and history homework with DJ, my son. And then at 4:45, one of my students is in profound mental distress, and I'm the advisor to that student. And there's something wrong with a colleague, or there's some big departmental snafu. And so I've got to call my wife, who is incredibly flexible and forgiving, but I can hear in her voice, this is not ideal. You said you would be home at 5:30. And so trying to be responsive to the needs of different groups. I mean, we all deal with this, whatever job we have, especially if you're committed to your job and doing it well. We're trying to be a writer. You know, trying to carve out time, make sure that I do a good job spending time with my son, with my wife, doing all of the stuff we need to do. But also, writing takes a lot of time and a lot of time by yourself.
You've also written about the sacrifices your wife has had to make career-wise and how it has been so difficult to balance her needs professionally with your needs professionally.
Right. And that's a big deal. And that's a really big deal when you have a child with a disability. And, you know, there aren't that many fully included kids with my son's form of autism. DJ types to communicate. He doesn't speak. He's got a lot of repetitive behavior, but he's super smart and he's done incredibly well. But we've been fortunate that we can get by, and I say get by, on one income so that she can do some consulting work, but also manage this experiment with inclusion. And the good part of this, the part that's satisfying to my wife, is that other kids and other families have seen this is really possible. We can really give a vigorous education to kids with significant disabilities. But it's tough. And, you know, we started this grand adventure sort of in the reverse. I was at home finishing a dissertation and the primary sort of caregiver. And we may switch again. I don't think this necessarily has to be this way. And anyway, he's going to go to college soon, and we're going to tackle the next ambitious part of this inclusion journey.
Also in your essay, you write about how strange it feels for you as the person who has written about your life with your son. You wrote a memoir. It's called Reasonable People, a Memoir of Autism and Adoption. And you traveled around giving readings, doing all the promotion that's necessary with a book. And you talked about some of the adulation you received from, particularly from the mothers of autistic children.
Right. I mean, it really, on some level, was perverse. First of all, disability doesn't cause divorce, but a child's significant disability can put considerable strain on a marriage. So the fact that I've written this memoir, the vast majority of memoirs about kids with disabilities written by mothers. So already I have some sort of, you know, halo around me. And then I'm there, and the book, I mean, I'm really involved in my son's life, but while I'm reading about really being involved in my son's life, I'm in Kansas City or in L.A., and I'm not involved in my son's life at that moment. And you could see some of the mothers in the saying, you know, you could see them sort of wishing that their husbands were as involved. And the paradox or the contradiction was not lost on me. And I try to be honest in that essay about the different burdens that the two parents shoulder.
This collection of essays on fatherhood by men in the Academy, I can see a lot of people looking at that title and thinking, well, that's not something for me. But who is this collection for?
Well, I mean, it's published by Rutgers University Press, and so it imagined this book as a kind of what they call a crossover book. So obviously it would have academic appeal for people in anthropology, sociology, generally in the profession, fathers. I was out at a conference in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago, and I was just watching people at the fair pick this book up, and they were intrigued. They want to know what other fathers are thinking and doing. But it's not an academic book in the sense that it's academic prose. These are personal essays, and some of them are incredibly funny. There's an essay by an administrator. His name is John Wells, and it's the most honest treatment of being an academic administrator I've ever heard in my life, and it is rip-roaring funny. And my colleague, Mark Montgomery, whom you're going to speak to next, is very, very funny, too. I force these guys to write this in an accessible way. And so, yes, it's about the Academy, but only because folks work there. It's really about fatherhood and contemplative fatherhood, how thinking deliberately, as Thoreau might say, about how to do this thing, you know, how to do this activity called fatherhood.
Well, Ralph, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having us on.
And it really is an engaging and interesting collection of essays. Ralph Savarese teaches American Literature, Disability Studies, and Creative Writing at Grinnell College. He is a co-editor and contributor to the collection Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. And I will be talking to another contributor to that collection in just a moment, Mark Montgomery, who also teaches at Grinnell College. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about fatherhood in many different forms. And of course, there are many, many more forms than the kinds we're talking about today. But my next guest is also a contributor to the collection that we were talking about a few minutes ago. It's called Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. And Mark Montgomery is the Donald Wilson Professor of Enterprise and Leadership and a Professor of Economics at Grinnell College. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And you are a father of three, and your family is unusual. You took the traditional route to having a daughter. You have a biological daughter. But then you decided to expand your family through adoption. Why did you make that decision?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I wish I had a good answer. The fact is that I think we, at that point in our lives, we felt that we had been very lucky, had a great kid, had great jobs, and we weren't really devoting much time to helping other people. And we could have volunteered to go down and build houses or something, but we were parents. We thought we were pretty good at that, and we had what economists call a comparative advantage in doing something through parenting. So we went out and tried to find some child who needed a home. That was a difficult process, actually.
Well, tell me a little bit about that process, because that there are many different routes that one can take to adoption, and you found that out very quickly.
Yes, and in a way, it's embarrassing to talk about. We went to the so-called waiting children of this state, who were older children and had been taken out of homes, and that process was very painful. Because there were so many kids, but the unpleasant fact of the matter is many of them had been very damaged by the experience of being in a dysfunctional family before they were removed. And we were afraid it would change our lifestyle, that we really could not accommodate that kind of change. We looked internationally and found a little boy in Costa Rica who seemed to be terrific, but again, he had fetal alcohol syndrome. And when we did some research on that and found out exactly what that entailed, we were afraid. And I say this with humility, shame, really, that we were afraid to take on a very a seriously problemed child with significant behavioral and emotional and intellectual difficulties.
You weren't just concerned about the commitment that you and your wife would be making to this child, but also you had an older child and you were concerned about what commitment you might be making on her behalf as well.
That's right. I mean, I said to one of the professionals whom we consulted, is it true, point blank, is it true that if we adopt this little boy, we may be his wards until we die and his sister will be his ward thereafter? And the woman said, yes, that is quite possibly true.
I've talked to several people over the years about adoption, and one of the women that wrote about her path to adoption said part of the very painful part of this process is that in saying yes to a child, you have to say no to so many others along the way.
Yes, you have. This is an awful metaphor, but if you'll forgive me, I've often thought of it as you have a lifeboat after the Titanic has sunk and you're rowing through the many, many people who are there in the water and need to be saved, but you're going to pick one and not pick others. And that's very difficult. It's very difficult.
Your middle son or your middle child, your older son, is an African-American boy who you adopted from Texas. What led you to him?
Well, we found out, and I don't know why this surprised us, that while healthy infants are in great supply, just watch the movie Juno, you'll find out about that, one of the exceptions is African-American and biracial kids, particularly boys, that these kids are not snapped up, certainly not snapped up by white couples. They're only about a white child is maybe 8 or 10 times more likely to be adopted than an African-American boy. So there was a chance to get an infant, somebody over whose raising we would have complete control. And yeah, there might be problems, but by the time problems showed up, he would emotionally be ours. And so we decided to go that route, and almost instantly we had a child.
When you decided that you, a Caucasian couple with a Caucasian daughter who live in Iowa, which is not a particularly diverse state, who live in Grinnell, Iowa, which is not a particularly diverse town in this not particularly diverse state, would adopt an African-American child, what issues did you struggle with?
That's a very good question, and it is not merely a question that you pose to a father, but it's also a policy issue. I was in London for the fall, and the issue of whether or not you should allow black children to go into white families is something that policymakers have struggled with. And there's no good answer to how you do it properly and whether the child wouldn't be better off in some other venue. But the fact is, there are not as many black families adopting as there are black children up for adoption. So in some sense, the question is moot. We worried about his identity. His mother made this big bulletin board with all kinds of pictures of famous African Americans and put it up in his room. And I said, well, he is only a month old, so it might take some time before this kicks in. And those were things we worried about. And I think the result has been quite good, but maybe the jury's still out.
In your essay, you also write about the fact that you personally needed to confront some of your own, not necessarily beliefs, but feelings about race.
Yeah. As much as we like to skip over difficult issues of differences among people, we confront them all the time. And the reputation of any racial group, that the Chinese work harder or that Jewish people are smarter or that Irish, like my parents, drink a lot, those are pernicious. But that doesn't mean that they're not there and that you can simply dismiss them. You can will them away. And I think it is very hard for parents of African Americans not to absorb the sense of intellectual inferiority. I don't want to use that word, but I have to, that people think black Americans suffer. And I think that's one of the reasons it makes it very difficult for people to adopt black children. And my attitude was, you know, if I'm afraid of that, if I can't dismiss that view, then by God, I'm going to have to deal with it. And one of the ways you deal with it is to have a child like that. So if my child is made to feel inferior or made to feel less smart, which, by the way, he turns out not to be, then I have to experience it too. And that seems, I don't know, somehow reasonable and just and good for both of us.
But you did have lower expectations for your son, you said.
I did have lower expectations for my son, partly because he was put up for adoption, and partly, and I'm ashamed to admit this, partly because, you know, there is that reputation. And my son is not below average in ability. He's above average in ability. He's not a particularly adept scholar in terms of his focus, but he is a smart guy. And I don't know. It requires a lot of self-examination. And I don't think that pretending that you don't have views like this is particularly healthy. I think I've become less of a racist by adopting my son. I feel that I've learned a lot about racial relations. And it's not always, lessons are not always happy, but they're very real.
You also have a third child, and your third child is also an African American boy, but he's an African American boy now, but he was originally from Africa. Why did you decide to adopt internationally the second time you adopted?
Well, Africa is full of orphans, and you would think it would be very easy to help some of those kids, and it's actually not. We wanted to adopt another child, my wife in particular. We had a great experience with our infant son, Kurt, and we thought, well, okay, it's the older kids who need it more. I guess we were willing to accept a slightly higher degree of risk, having had a great experience with our little boy. And so we knew from the internet, you know, that Sierra Leone had terrible problems. There was an orphanage that we came across that had a number of children that were up for adoption, and I guess we felt older and more ready to take what we thought might be a larger risk.
And tell me about your son's story. Where did he come from, and how old was he?
He was 6 and a half when he came from Sierra Leone. His parents were murdered by the rebel soldiers, possibly right in front of him, when he was about 2 to 3. And he then was taken in by an aunt, and she was unable to care for him and his young cousin, and they eventually sent them to a shelter where they could be fed and get medical care, and the shelters put them up for adoption. So we got him. He'd been with his parents for 2 years. He came to us at 6 and a half. It was a strange experience for all of us, I guess. And that that has worked out fabulously well. We're incredibly blessed with our experiences as parents.
One of the things you write about in your essay is that because you have this personal experience and there are people you are related to who are African American, this gives you a different perspective when engaging in racial debate on campus. And of course, at Grinnell College is a more racially diverse environment than the town of Grinnell is. And so how does that play out for you professionally?
Well, race, as you've pointed out, is an incredibly sensitive issue on campus. And among the students, among faculty, the struggle to diversify faculty and staff, most of the better colleges are trying to do this. There are difficulties in doing it. And there are fewer African American scholars and teachers as a proportion of the population than there are students. And so whatever one says about race, one does so with real trepidation. As I opened the essay, I was talking to an African American colleague of mine in a forum of race, and I was giving her a little heat. She's a lovely person and we're friends, but I was giving her a little heat about what she was saying, that the institution had behaved in a racial way. And first-year students started yelling at me. Black kid said, you can't talk to her that way, and you're being incredibly rude. And if I had not been the father of two black children and knew that I could, in some sense, survive the charge, the implicit charge of racism, I might have been very reluctant to do that.
Well, that story is... It's very funny in that you were branded as a racist that got around campus and actually reached your daughter's ears.
Yeah. Yes, and my daughter said, I hear you're a racist, Dad. And I said, well, you know, I have to admit, I do talk harshly to black people. You know, I had said to a black person this morning, Jabrilla, you're going to miss the bus. And the night before, I had, you know, yelled at a black person, Kurt, it's 11:30. Why aren't you in bed? And I admitted I do this pretty much every day.
Regularly. How has being the father of African-American boys changed your personal identity? Because, of course, you know, to look at you on the street, one would not suspect a racial diversity in your background. But how has that changed who you are?
That's very interesting. It's sometimes interesting to pause and think we have a very different kind of family, not just in terms of race, but in the way we've parented. I like to put this, only an economist could say something as absurd as this. But I say, well, you know, in our parenting, we have, like getting vegetables, we've grown our own, we've bought them at the store, and we've actually imported them from abroad, okay? And this horrifies most people, but it is in a sense true.
Yeah, you also use the term outsourcing.
Outsourcing the pregnancy.
Right.
And it's one of the things I'm most happy about in my life, that we did this, and I'm deeply grateful to my wife, without whose impetus I don't think it would have happened. And I can't always track my changes, but you know, it's a very interesting question. But I think it says to me, well, you know, it is really possible for very different people, at least very different looking people, to live together and love each other and work together in the same family. That can happen. However much it doesn't seem to work on the outside, it works very well at 1303 Main Street in Grinnell, Iowa, and I think that's a hopeful thought.
Your boys are certainly old enough now to have thoughts about this themselves. Do you talk about this?
Well, you said the key word, boys. My oldest son does not want to talk about race very much at all. I think he doesn't want to emphasize his difference with other people. Our youngest son, actually, one interesting thing about him is Sierra Leone, for example. We've tried to connect him with people from Sierra Leone. We've tried to go see Sierra Leone. He wants nothing to do with Sierra Leone. He has erected, as the New York Times put it, a firewall between his life now and his life then. He's a little more willing to talk about race because he went from an all-black world to an all-white world. Overnight, literally overnight. And I think he's a little more cognizant of racial differences. But their lives are pretty much the lives of typical teenagers, as far as I know. And they don't want to dwell on that issue at all. I mean, it's you could be with them for a month and not think they were even aware of it, though occasionally you do see times when it pops up in odd ways in a lot of their friends are black, or some of the people they care about on television or movie stars are black. So you see it in indirect ways.
Well, and as you said, these ideas about race become deeply embedded, and they're something that you had to think about hard when you became a father. And I'm sure that
yes.
As they get older, they'll think about them hard as well.
I think that's right. And both of them have very different issues to confront in their pasts. And do they want to have any connection with the past? Do they want to find out about their birth families? How much does it say? What does it say about who they are? You know, do those guys know exactly who they are? I really don't know. They'll be different. They're teenagers, and through time they're going to change. And I couldn't actually predict what they will say at age 30 about their past and about their racial identity. I just don't know.
Mark, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Montgomery is a professor of economics at Grinnell College. He's also one of the contributors to the collection Papa PhD, Essays on Fatherhood by Men in the Academy. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, out-of-date technology in defunct magazine.